It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, welcome to United Hour. I'm your host, Imran, and today we've got a very special podcast with a very special guest. He is the senior sports writer for The Times. I'd like to introduce you all to Matt Dickinson. Matt, welcome to United Hour.
Thank you for inviting me. Plenty to talk about, I think.
There's plenty of talk to talk about of United at the moment. Matt has just recently published a book. In fact, it's out today, I believe, entitled 1999, Manchester United, The Treble and All That. It's a fantastic book that we will get into more detail in a moment. But just to start, Matt, you were the one who broke the story about Sir Jim Ratcliffe being interested in potentially buying Man United or wanting to become involved in Man United in the future. What do you think sets this one apart? I mean, we've been there before as United fans, you know, people wanting to buy the club and then it never materialised and we're just stuck with the Glazers constantly. Do you think there's anything about this one that sets it apart?
Well, I think it's different from the buyer's end in the sense of, you know, we know that he is a very rich man for starters. We know that he is definitely interested in sport, both professionally and personally. You know, Ineos have got involved in all sorts of sports, including football at Nice in the French league. They, you know, they're not messing around there. They've spent a lot of money this summer to try and get into the Champions League. We know that he tried, obviously, you know, left it too late to bid for Chelsea, but, you know, came to that table. And we know he's a Man United fan who is approaching, the way he has put it to me when we've talked before, is that he's approaching 70. He's got billions in the bank, basically. And he wants to use it to live life to the full. And sport is one way of doing that. So, you know, I think he's, you know, he also doesn't strike me as a sort of flaky character. You know, he hasn't built a petrochemicals business from scratch and become a billionaire without, you know, being a fairly sort of serious player. So for all those reasons, I think his interest is there. But at the same time, the but, and there's a big but, is that we're dealing with the Glazers. And you know, no one knows exactly what they want. No one knows exactly, you know, we've got all kinds of bits of information and rumour and speculation about their plans. We know that Old Trafford needs an absolute fortune spending on it, and they're not the type who are going to just say, well, we'll pay for that, are they? So there's a lot of sense that adds up. There's six siblings and only two of them engage in a football team. So there's lots of reasons why it's... does seem that they're inviting some kind of injection of, but whether that becomes a partnership with Ratcliffe, whether Ratcliffe can buy the club, I'm afraid I would have to say there's some massive ifs and buts still to be addressed.
Yeah, there's one thing being interested in buying Man United. There's a whole other thing to actually be able to. We've seen the Glazers this week want to sell off minority shares, and that's looking like an American investment fund already in line for that. So even that is kind of closed off. From your perspective on the kind of inside track and journalism circles, what impression of the Glazers do you get in terms of their wanting this sticker? Do you get much information from them at all? Is it quite of a closed door compared to other clubs?
Oh, it's the most closed door in football almost. I mean, you know, we pick around the sort of edges of the Glazers as much as we can, and you know, there are two or three people who are sort of licensed to shall we say, speak on their behalf at times. But even that is sort of painful and comes out in a dribble and, you know, often is a question of sort of trying to read between the lines. I mean, I know in the last year since the Super League debacle that the, you know, Joel Glazer's come on a couple of Zoom calls, there's been talk of fan involvement and share scheme and stuff, but you know, that's still to be proved to be more than platitudes. You know, my approach to the Glazers as a journalist, it probably reflects a lot of the approach of the fans to the Glazers, which is, you know, I'll believe it when I see it and I'll sort of assume the worst otherwise, because everything we've seen about the club, the way it's run, the priorities, you know, the way that the performance culture has been eroded year after year, the way Ed Woodward ran it, transfer strategy, you know, we could go on and on. Yeah, has left us thinking that these are particularly poor owners of a football club, and they just happen to own the one of the most obviously celebrated and successful in the history of football.
Well, yeah, we talk about how it's run, and I think nothing has been more apparent about the way United has run or lack of cohesion with its run with this summer. I'm personally, as I'm a United fan, I've never known a summer like this in terms of just transfer rumours, things happening here, there and everywhere. Suddenly, I mean, we've got a guy on the podcast called Nick. He lives and died by the BBC. If it's on the BBC, it's accurate. And the BBC this year have actually put us in, we've been confirmed deals with a lot of players that just haven't happened. Have you ever seen a summer like this, especially for a club like United?
I think the worst thing about it is the fact that it should have been a reset summer. You know, you've got a new chief exec, effectively, Richard Arnold, who's come in after Woodward. You know, Woodward, we know, made a mess of things, but Richard Arnold also had a running start to this summer. You know, it wasn't like he arrived in the middle of it. We also, you know, and he's been at the club for ages. We knew that Erik ten Hag, you know, he wasn't appointed midsummer. We knew he was coming, you know, with plenty of time to get a window sorted out. You know, there are so many reasons why it should have been a summer where everyone could say, ah, you know what, we've hit rock bottom and this is, you know, this is where it starts getting some credibility back. And instead, you know, it's been the opposite. I mean, obviously Casemiro, we can debate about, you know, I mean, he is obviously a, you know, well-established player, but the fact is that even that, you know, you suddenly think, well, why is this suddenly appearing so late? Why is it, it's a different profile to the other players we're talking about. And yeah, Erik ten Hag should have been arriving and being told, by the way, we have just done 2-3 years work setting up these targets. We know the 5 centre-backs who are the best in Europe. You know, if you want Koulibaly, we can go and get him for X. If you want the 20-year-old version, we can get for Y. Instead, obviously, they signed Martinez because that's what he knew. That the Dutch league is different from the English league, and we're already seeing some of the ramifications of that. So, yeah, I mean, in short, it should have been a summer where there was a big reset, different people doing it differently. And instead, we've just seen one problem after the other. And, you know, Ronaldo's another, you know. I mean, basically, the coach has got a real problem with him. No one else will take him. It's a mess. And, you know, the club has to hope that that does not become a mess that hangs over the dressing room for months after months.
Well, we'll see what happens with Ronaldo as the window ticks by. But all this depressing current Man United is not what we're here to talk about. No. We are here to talk about possibly the greatest season of all time in English football. Certainly, as my Sporting United of 35 years, my favourite season of all time. The 1999 season. Matt has written a wonderful book, Man United, The Treble and All That. It's out now. It is genuinely a fantastic read. Matt, what was the inspiration for this book? I mean, obviously, we just had the 20 years a couple of years ago, but what made you want to go back and revisit this season?
I think, to be honest, there's a few things. I mean, one, I mean, you know, obviously, it remains the most, the simple fact remains the most successful season by an English football club ever. And, you know, we've seen how close Liverpool and Man City seem to have got in the last couple of years. You know, there was obviously lots of talk of quadruples at one stage. You know, and yeah, they've fallen short, and that's underlined just how unbelievably hard it is to get a treble, never mind a quadruple. So you know, there is the uniqueness of the feat. There is the fact that, as a reporter, every time you know I meet up as a bald, older, graying bloke, and we have reminiscences about you know the glory days. Somehow the stories always end up back at Ferguson era. back at this campaign in particular. It's just where it's where there was the most fun to be had as a reporter. You're following these, you know, biggest team in the world with some of the most amazing games in the world, and crucially, some of the most interesting characters that I've ever come across. The feat is one thing, the treble, but actually, I think what makes this book interesting and makes the story interesting is that we are talking about a dressing room that is full of absolutely mesmerizing people. Roy Keane, I mean, to younger audience, obviously they see him now as this, feisty, fiery pundit. I mean, imagine seeing that in midfield every week and the intensity of that. David Beckham becomes the most famous, athlete on the planet. Gary Neville we see every week, who has become, all these guys, Peter Schmeichel, not just perhaps the world's greatest goalkeeper, but a huge, interesting character. Could go on. York and Cole become this amazing partnership, and it's not just a partnership of skills and talents, but of personalities. And so, I was lucky enough to be there at the time to cover it, to be up closer than we can get now. In that time, we travelled with the team on planes on European trips. We could be, I've been lucky enough to do Gary Neville's autobiography. I did a book with Beckham. So there was a bit more of an intimacy as well. So all these things combined to make me just think, hang on a minute, this was the greatest season ever. It was the most fascinating season ever. It was the most dramatic season ever. It was the most amazing personalities. And, if there's not a book in that, then I'm in the wrong job, basically.
Well, it's told wonderfully well through many, many chapters. We were talking just before we came on about how I enjoyed the shortness of these chapters. Each one, I think maximum, maybe 5-6 pages each chapter. And did that come about organically through the fact that there's just so many characters, there's so many stories to tell?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it was like a eureka moment, to be honest. And I can't claim the credit for myself. I knew I wanted to go back there and see it. And I knew what I didn't want to do is write some big stodgy, this happened in September, this happened in October. I wanted it to be chronological because that makes sense, but I didn't want it to be just a sort of report of matches that everyone knows about. I wanted it to feature these characters and lots of interesting quirks. Like one chapter is about the kid, Alex Notman.
That was my favorite chapter in the book. A person I've not thought about for 20 years. And he just
brilliant.
Like,
well,
that name.
Yeah. Exactly. So people, a couple of mates have said, what was the best bit? Expecting me to say, having an hour with David Beckham or, getting the inside track from Teddy Sheringham. But so for those who don't know, Alex Notman was a very promising kid at United at the time. And in the middle of the treble season, it's the League Cup, and he comes on as a substitute. So he's made his debut. He's hit the big time in his eyes, and he's playing in the treble season. And the next day he comes into training and Alex Ferguson sits him down and says, son, you're on your way now. There's a whole Man United career waiting for you. And as without spoiling too much surprise, he never plays for the club again. And when we spoke, he was a gas engineer living near Norwich. And, I didn't know any of that when I first started the story. It sort of slipped off my radar and, I'm sure most United fans' radar. But I wanted to feature him because, A, it shows how thin the line is between, glory and ending up as a, with respect to gas engineer in Norwich. And B, it just also underlines, I guess, how special the Scholes and the Nevilles and Giggs and Beckham are to have made it, to have, that line is that thin, and it takes not just talent, but, awful lot of character and luck and everything else to suddenly find you've played 500 games for Man United. That, I guess, is one snapshot of where I thought if I do 99 chapters, I can bring in a character like Alex Notman, actually give him, I think, the space and the respect he deserves. Whereas in another book, a different format, that could get reduced to a couple of paragraphs and almost feel lost in it. So, I'm really pleased you like the format. As soon as I realised it was a different way of doing it, instantly I was like, great, I love that. And I think it allows me to tell all these different stories that otherwise might sort of fall away.
Yeah, as a United fan, I cannot, and a self-professed non-book reader, I can't recommend this book enough to fellow United fans and to football fans. It's such an easy pick up and read, and you'll end up reading 5 or 6 chapters before you know it. It's, I cannot recommend it enough. But anyway, going back, you mentioned, obviously, you talked to a lot of players for this book. York, Sheringham, Jesper Blomqvist, Andy Cole, a whole range. How willing do you find them to talk about this season than, say, other topics when you've come across them in the past? How much fire inside them do you see about talking about the 99 season?
Yeah, well, I mean, they were all, I mean, the ones I got hold of, obviously, were, for most of them, it's like, you know, basically, do you mind sparing some time to talk about, you know, the greatest season of your life? And it's, you know, happy days, why wouldn't I? But there are complications even with that. I mean, Teddy Sheringham was one of the most, I mean, Teddy at the time, as dealing as a journalist, could be quite aloof and, you know, he wasn't the easiest to get to know. And, you know, I think, you know, it's not just me saying that. He would say that himself, that he could be like that at the time. But it's actually now going back and talking with 20 years perspective, he would really opened up about actually it was hard for him. You know, everyone thinks, you won the treble, you scored at the Nou Camp, those, you know, happy days. And actually he said, no, it was, that year was really tough. He said his United career was really tough. He didn't feel he fitted in the dressing room that well. You know, there was a class of 92 sort of gang, and then there was York and Cole, and he had a terrible relationship with Andy Cole that people know about. And what I didn't know about till we sat down and had never come out before was that he had this shocking relationship with Roy Keane as well. I mean, he wasn't sure whether to tell that story. And in the end, he just went, oh, you know, sod it. You know, there's enough water under the bridge. And so I don't know if people have seen the extracts that the Times had, but basically they were in a minibus with a few of the lads, and Keane suddenly turned around and basically tried to fight him and called him, you know, F off back to London, your Cockney and your Ferrari and your penthouse, and it all kicked off. And Keane never spoke to him again for 3 years as teammates. And you know, it's, we can laugh about it now, but you imagine at the time, you know, you're in this dressing room, you know, and again, that's the complex dynamics of that. I just found fascinating. Everyone must think, or easily thinks, you know, they won the treble, they must have been this band of brothers, it must have been, you know, this amazing team spirit. And it was just really interesting to me as a sports writer and studying greatness and what makes greatness. Actually, it's way more complicated than that. And there was all this, you know, Roy Keane and Peter Schmeichel at times wanted to rip each other's heads off. But I guess that's the genius of Alex Ferguson, was that all this stuff was going on, and yet he kept everyone on the straight and narrow. And I guess it takes a special leader and a special manager to have these big alpha, you know, players in a dressing room, and, you know, not just a few of them, to have, you know, 15 of them, and to keep them, you know, basically to allow a certain amount of you know, macho feistiness, but somehow, you know, keep everyone's eyes on the prize, basically.
Yeah, I think the thing that comes across really well in the book is just the characters of the obviously, there's obviously a lot of football covered in the book, and we talk about the games, but it's really the characters of these people and what made them the people they are. We talk about how Andy Cole's a bit of an introvert, how Roy Keane is Roy Keane. Everyone knows how Roy Keane is, how Gary Neville's a bit of a pupil, how close those guys were. It's fascinating insight into these people as characters. I don't feel like these days you just get a dressing room like that anymore. It's such a different time almost. Do you kind of miss it in a way?
I do. Well, I think, you know, I miss the intimacy as a journalist. I definitely do, because, you know, I think it did. I think they certainly as well had a sort of boldness that, you know, in dealings with us, the media, they, you know, used to have real old ding dongs. I mean, I think I mentioned, you know, in the book, I think I tell a story of once I did we were going out to the Borussia Dortmund 97 semi-final, the first leg. And I did an interview at the airport with Peter Schmeichel when I asked him, you know, how do you think this team would get on against the 68 team? And he said, oh, we'd probably beat them 10-0, because, you know, you see how fast they run and how fast we run. And I got his point, and he put it in context, but obviously he stick that in the headline and it didn't look so clever. So anyway, and then he got injured that for that game. United obviously lost 1-0 in Germany, didn't make it to the final. And next thing I know, I've got a 6'4" Danish goalie running at me on the way back, screaming, saying, you know, you stitched me up, you X, Y, Z. And we had a, you know, we had a right old, shall we say, ding dong about it. But that's what we loved as journalists, that there was that relationship. And, you know, Peter Schmeichel, like, we got over it, and, you know, it life moved on. But I loved the fact that there was that, you know, close up and personal. They knew who we were. And, you know, if you wrote something that someone didn't like, you would hear about it quite soon, especially obviously where Alex Ferguson was. So I don't want to be, you know, I'm probably in the danger of saying, you know, sounding too like, oh, they were the good old days. But, there's now, to be a football reporter now is still an amazing job. But I do think, you know, now you tend to be dealing much more with agents or representatives or the brother of the player, you know, the mum or the dad, rather than the player themselves. That's just shows how the media has changed, how the size of football fame and celebrity has changed as well.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
When we talk about characters, there is no, I feel, bigger character in this team than Roy Keane. And Roy Keane's an interesting one in this book because, I mean, to give a bit of the book away, they're often split. It's split into chapters, and then often players will come up chapters and the players take up chapters more towards the beginning. But Roy Keane, he's there throughout. He's always there. He's a menace. He's always there. And then he gets his call at the end, obviously, when the Juventus come into play. But I probably would say Roy probably mentioned probably the second most after Fergie, maybe. Do you feel like his footprints are all over this season and all over this book? Is there a bigger character than Roy Keane, and the stuff that he did for the season is incredible?
No, I think it's interesting you spotted that, because I was very conscious of it, because I started off, and the book, again, without, you know, well, I don't think it's spoiling anything. The book is actually bookended by Beckham, effectively, because he gets the sending off in the 98 World Cup, obviously, and he's coming back off that, and he's this national scapegoat, and it finishes not just with the Nou Camp, but Posh and Beck's the wedding, you know, which sort of tells a bit of a circle of sort of redemption for him. But, and I, you know, when I first started the project, I wondered if it was Beckham was going to be almost the, you know, the sort of the main character, basically, the sort of, you know, hero, the sort of biggest hero of the story. But the more I did it, the more Keane 100% emerged as absolutely the sort of thread through the book, the same way he is through that team. I think, you know, it was, I knew obviously he'd been injured the season before, but it was only coming to the research that, and speaking to the physio at United at the time, that I realised just how. So yes, it was a different, totally different Roy Keane that comes back. You know, he's, you know, he was just insanely competitive. He was determined to absolutely make the best of a, almost like a second chance after serious injury. And, you know, he, you know, the chat, I describe a tackle he does in the Charity Shield coming back, where he just throws himself at the air. You know, he's coming back from a cruciate knee ligament. You know, most players would be sort of feeling their way back, and he's like, no way, I'm just, you know, I'm coming at you, and I'm gonna get my trophies back, basically. And I think it's still one of the great underrated seasons. You know, the following year he wins PFA and Football Writers Players of the Year. It's nuts to me that he didn't win it that year. When I spoke to the players, I said, who would have been your vote? And they said Roy Keane by a mile. You know, I think Teddy Sheringham, who obviously fell out with Roy, said if he wasn't there for a training session, it was less intense. This, you know, it wasn't just matches. Every day, Roy Keane kept this team on their toes to, you know, a sort of insane level. And I think, you know, he was at his peak physically. He was more determined than ever, and he was absolutely the engine of the treble. It doesn't happen without him, you know, and that's even without just sort of one-off games like Turin, obviously away, when, you know, it definitely doesn't happen without him.
No, but not as good as David Ginola. We have to concede.
That's well, yeah. Well, I'd say I think I try and get my excuses. So yeah, for people who don't know, David Ginola wins the Footballer of the Year that year, which is still a sort of, you know, embarrassment for the organisations that put him up there. I mean, he had a couple of good. I mean, he was a wonderful player to watch, but
he hit form at the right time.
Yes, Fergie couldn't stand him because he was a diver, called him such. And also there was the fact that the voting was basically before any of the trophies had been sorted. So it was sort of skewed by that. And actually, because of it, the system changed to push the voting back as late as possible. But yeah, I mean, you know, you would have had any sensible vote by the end of May would have had, you know, Keane, York and Stam and Beckham ahead of Ginola without any question.
So yeah, Beckham is another one throughout the book. Again, you start with him, you finish with him. It's quite like we go back now and think about the vitriol that he had, and it is quite staggering actually. If you weren't alive at the time, if you're very young and you were there, it's beyond what you probably could imagine. I mean, if Jack Grealish, for instance, I mean, I'm picking Jack Grealish because he's sort of a similar character. If he got sent off in a World Cup semi quarterfinal in Qatar, could you even see it being half of what Beckham got?
No, I mean, I think it is interesting to sort of look back, obviously, as a journalist and look back on just think, well, yeah, wow, what was it that made it so? I mean, I think one thing is this is pre-social media, you know, it's before the internet, and I think newspapers there was more power basically in the mainstream newspaper industry, and I think that dictated and, well, tried to reflect and dictate a public mood at the same time. So if the front page of a newspaper, particularly obviously a sort of mass market, you know, tabloid paper, felt like it was sort of, you know, it was absolutely the public opinion. So when the Mirror do a big headline and is it 10 heroic lions, one stupid boy, you know, I mean, that the power of that was just immense. And it fueled this, yeah, as you say, I mean, utter vitriol. I mean, you know, we had absolute people camped outside the Beckham family house, the parents' house, the grandparents' house. It was, you know, dartboards with, I mean, I interviewed Piers Morgan for the book. And when you have Piers Morgan saying, I think we went too far, then, you know, I mean, this is a guy who's like, you know, anti-cancel culture, you know, freedom of speech, everything goes, you know, opinion on everything. But yeah, even he said, you know what, I look back and just think, yeah, we went over the top. So that just shows you. And there was a lot of questions, serious questions at the time. Could he come back? Could he even play in England? Would he just flee straight away? Was it going to be unbearable? And which just shows you, you know, the level of scorn that was, you know, I mean, in some ways, you know, everyone has a voice on Twitter, but you can, you know, you can turn it off, ignore it. But at the time, it felt like Beckham was literally physically being hounded. He was being chased everywhere he went. Mm.
And just go again, shows the mental strength that he has and the character of everyone, not just him, but everyone in the squad. Again, you're touching it a lot, the mental strength that they all have. It's quite something. And then another big character in the book, well, not a big character in the book necessarily, but another who I quite enjoy when he ever chips in is Dwight York. Just seems like the most cheerful, lovely man alive.
And such a contrast to the rest of them. I mean, I think that was again, I mean, Ferguson, and I think, you know, he admits himself that he was a bit lucky with this. You know, Dwight York was on his radar. He admired him as a player. He thought, yeah, there was this really versatile forward. He could play on the wing, he could play as a 10, he could play as a 9, you know, technical and physical. But, you know, he chased other targets. I mean, if Patrick Cliver had said, I'm coming, then Dwight York probably never ends up there. Or, you know, what combination of forward? They chase after Patrick Cliver, bid for Patrick Cliver, who was at AC Milan, have a bid accepted, And who knows how history, you know, it's one of those sliding doors moments of how history could have been different. But Kluivert goes off to Barcelona instead, wins one league in 4 years, which I'm sure gives, you know, United fans and Fergie a chuckle. And Dwight York comes right on the deadline. You've got this dressing room that's just full of, as we've talked about, these, you know, sort of insanely intense characters. And Dwight York turns up and starts doing keepy-uppy, telling jokes, high fives, saying, right, who's coming off to the bar? And I think I say in the book, it's like introducing a sort of Hawaiian shirt and a cocktail bar into Salford. I mean, that was the cultural sort of difference that Dwight York had in terms of his just sort of, you know, this is fun, you know, this isn't meant to be pressure. He says, like, you know, I'm playing for Aston Villa and now I'm joining Man United and I've got Beckham and Giggs hitting crosses in. I mean, what's not to like? And it's not only the impact he had with that confidence, because, you know, people will know that, you know, there's a lot of players, especially strikers, who have basically died a death at United because of the pressure and expectation. And Andy Cole has struggled at times. You know, he scored goals, he'd won trophies, he'd had a respectable time at United, but I don't think he'd really fired. And it was only when Dwight York turns up and basically says, mate, you know, I'm here to play alongside you, I'm here to bring out the best in you, that he actually relaxed. And suddenly there was this incredible double act, which, you know, I mean, they scored. Yeah, I think I talk in the book.
Well, I want to say thank you, because you have a chapter fully dedicated to my favourite goal in Manchester United history, which is the Andy Cole goal at the Camp Nou, which is just beautiful. As you describe it, it is like art being played out.
That's your favourite United goal ever?
My favourite United goal.
Wow.
Definitely. Yeah, probably. I mean, yeah. It might change on a different day, but reading that, I was like, yeah, it's back to number one again. But it is just a fabulous goal. And you even said Ole used it when he was coaching. They make if they could have that chemistry. So it's just a fantastic goal.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think like all the best football, it is both intricate and simple. You know, there's something, I mean, the 1-2, we all learn that at, you know, age sort of 8 years old on the part, but to be able to do it with the speed and the accuracy and the simplicity that they do, just to go 1-2, 1-2 to slice through a defence in Barcelona, in the Nou Camp, in another humdinger of a cup tie. And again, it's the way Andy Cole, who at times had looked, you know, anxious and you know, snatching shots and stuff, the way he just finishes like, this is fun. And, you know, even Andy Cole is now looking like, I'm here to enjoy myself, to score goals. Again, just fascinating to see the personalities and how they gelled like that.
That's just one, obviously, there's a lot of the book is dedicated to the football. And what I found quite exciting or interesting for me was when you were describing the football, but all just, I mean, the 99 season, I watched it a load when I was a kid. And then, but yeah, I haven't watched the season highlights of that for a long time, but then it all comes flooding back when you're describing it. Did you find out when you were going back to research it, when you're looking at the footage, that it all just came flooding back as well? And all these things, all these memories, and you're like, oh, I remember this goal.
Well, is that, I mean, I'd shame on me that I'd actually forgotten. I mean, I went back and obviously looking at my own sort of journey through and, you know, the Liverpool FA Cup game comeback. I mean, I'd, you know, it was really interesting me to go and read back my own report from doing it. And I'd just forgotten how deafening that day was, because it was a cup tie. And that meant that Liverpool had more allocation of fans. I think they had, you know, huge, I think it might have been 8,000.
It would be 8,000 behind the side, yeah.
Yeah. And so just reading back to remember that, what, you know, because we tend to think, you know, chewing away, we tend to think the Villa Park with a replay, you know, we tend to think of the Nou Camp games or whatever. But yeah, just to read back and just think, wow, that game in itself was like epic, and the noise was deafening and the tension became excruciating. I some of the games, I mean, obviously I watched back all the goals and I watched back plenty of highlights, but yeah, three or four games I managed to obviously go back and literally watch. You know, sometimes you try and watch back an old game and think, is this going to look a bit tame and a bit dull? But actually, you know, to watch Villa Park back again, to watch obviously the final back again, to watch, you know, watch Turin. I mean, I have to say the Turin, the first half of Turin away, you know, I mean, I was like, you know, getting the hairs on the, you know, as you suddenly find yourself wrapped up in it again, thinking, are they going to do it? Are they going to do it? And when a game stands the test of time like that, that you can watch it back again and be gripped more than 20 years later, then you know you've been at something very special.
I mean, it's incredible, actually. If you think about it, not many teams will ever come back from one goal down with 88 minutes to go once every 10 years, and we did it twice in the season. Or the Liverpool game will forever be my shame, because after that first goal went in, we equalised. My dad was like, right, we've got to go, because I think we had to go somewhere. And I was too young to say no. So we ended up seeing the second goal in the concourse just on the TV. And I didn't forgive my dad for that one for a while. So we're talking about the games, and a couple of big games stick out. So we obviously have the FA Cup semi-final, which for a lot of people's money and mine is one of the greatest games of English football, certainly in the modern era, certainly in my time following football. I assume that's one of the ones you did go watch 90 minutes of, because what a great excuse to go watch 90 minutes of that game.
Well, 120. Was it? Yes.
120. Yeah. Sorry.
And I think I mentioned that, you know, even Tony Adam. So, you know, I want, again, we talked about bringing in the different chapters, different characters, spoke to Tony Adams for that one, because I just wanted a different perspective on it. And yeah, he talks about, you know, he goes after the game to see his sister, and, you know, obviously he's just lost, you know, their hopes of a double have just gone up in smoke. He's absolutely gutted. And the first thing his sister says is basically, what an amazing game. You know, it wasn't like, sorry, you lost, or, you know, the referee was a git or whatever. It's just like, wow, what a night. And that just shows you, you know, even the sort of vanquished team were just thinking that, you, I think there's a times on a pitch where, you know, sports people suddenly know, they know they're involved in something that's beyond the ordinary. And that was a night when, you know, I mean, it was just electric from start. I mean, it felt like, you know, the heavyweight championship of the world, didn't it? It wasn't just an FA Cup tie. This was like, who is the best team out there? And, you know, it's going to be a 12-round slugfest to find out, basically.
Yeah, we missed the days of the Man United-Arsenal rivalry. It was very intense back then, as you've detailed in the book. Is that your favourite Premier League rivalry, do you think?
Well, I think it is, because the managerial rivalry was so fascinating. You know, Fergie and Wenger was not just professional, that was personal as well. You know, that right at the start of it, you know, it was just blowing up then. And I think the way that there was a physicality to the, you know, I think the combination of styles made for a brilliant rivalry on the pitch as well. The fact that, you know, and Gary Neville was basically, he was very explicit that he thinks that the 98 going into 99 Arsenal team was the hardest they faced, because, you know, they were so tough and powerful and physical as well. Obviously Vieira and Petit coming in, they didn't yet, you know, they had more speed in Overmars, and I think he found that basically the later teams, they could bully a bit, you know, and Gary in particular was one of those who set about that bullying. But I think they've, you know, that 98 to sort of 99 time, and, you know, it was the league title was decided by a fraction, basically. So I think for all sorts of reasons, you know, and, you know, basically you got to sort of believe what these players tell you, and they tell you that that was that rivalry at its most intense and at its most ferocious. And there was, you know, so little to separate, the teams. I mean, Arsenal still feel like, you know, could have done back-to-back doubles. You know, they were a fraction away.
I would say it's worth picking up the book for all these different viewpoints of our players. As you said, like Arsenal players, later Bayern Munich, but their viewpoint on how these games went. And just, I mean, Paul Scholes touched on his performances and in his typical Scholes self-deprecating way.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Obviously, another big game. Then we go on to the Turin game, as you said. Like, incredible stuff. What was that like? One being there at the time, but like going back there, did it bring it all again? Just bring it all back. I'm basically just here to talk about the good times. That's all.
Yeah, well, understand. I mean, it was good. It was just great fun to go back. I mean, I remember. I've got mixed memories of Turin because the stadium. Any fan will know who went there. I mean, the stadium was managed to be both quite new and an absolute shambles. Basically, it was Stadio delle Alpi. It only been built in for the 1990 World Cup and was already sort of falling apart, you know, 9 years later. And it was, so basically, you know, I mean, the world's smallest violin is going to come out for this, but there were basically, the technology didn't work there either. And this was, again, pre-Wi-Fi and pre, you know. So I had the world's worst night trying to get my write my copy and file it and stuff. So this absolute epic of a match is going on and I'm basically punching my laptop, you know, if it was even called a laptop then. But it was just, I think, say that half, the first half in particular, to go back and watch it is like, you know, it's, you know, obviously famously United go 2-0 down. And I think I was writing a book at that stage. I've literally started typing into machine, you know, another European campaign over. I think I turned to my colleague at the time and just said, oh, well, that's that, you know, that's that then. And, you know, we're talking Juventus away. Juventus have been to 3 consecutive European Cup finals. We're talking Zidane and Deschamps and Davids and, you know, and Conte, who was just as mad on the pitch then as he's now on the sidelines managing Tottenham. But yeah, they were an absolute top team. And the idea that anyone could come back from 2-0 down after 20 minutes was pretty much unthinkable. But United did it. And, you know, they by half time, they were not just back in the game, but dominant and flying. And it was just, you know, there's a picture of Gary always talks of, Neville always talks about a picture of him and Beckham at the end of that game, that the two of them are sort of arm in arm. I think they might be holding their badges and stuff. And he says that's possibly his favourite picture ever from football, just because this was the night when they just took that next step. And I think as they walked off that, they just knew this is, you know, I think it had happened at the Villa Park, and then to do that and then lurch straight onto Turin, I just think they knew there's something in the air here. There is something that is going on, and we've got to make the most of it.
Well, speaking of giant rewrites, is there a bigger rewrite in the history of sport than the 1999 Champions League final?
Never has been, never will be. So those, you know, without being too technical, so if people don't know, I mean, and it's still the case now, even with, you know, technology has not changed the fact that, you know, as a reporter, if you are covering a night match, you have to have a report for the first edition of the newspapers over at the whistle, not 10 minutes after. It's got to be at the whistle. So that basically means that you are writing from the first minute. You know, you have a chunk done by half time, and you during the second half you're watching the game. That's why you need to touch type, because you're sort of watching the game while rattling away. So after 89 minutes in the Nou Camp, I have already sent 1,000 words on how Fergie sort of basically screwed up the tactics, put Giggs on the right, what was he thinking, you know, had he picked the wrong team, Blomqvist has had a nightmare, he's not been in good form, his confidence was gone. And, you know, the damp squib. So, you know, we've all, and I'm not the only, you know, we've all sent our stuff after 89, 90 minutes. And then Teddy Sheringham equalises and it's like, oh, well, wow, amazing. It's one all. We're going to have extra time. We've got another 30 minutes to sort of, you know, get our heads straight and get our match report sorted out. And, of course, bang, the most famous Man United goal in history, one of the most famous goals ever in history, flies in off Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's boot. And at that point, you know, is the greatest noise you've ever heard. But that, which would have drowned out the screams in the press box of, oh my God, I've got about 30 seconds to describe the most amazing football story in history.
I can't imagine the contrast between I am witnessing football history with I need to do my job.
Well, it is. I mean, it's sort of like, and there is that sort of, there's nowhere else I want to be on earth than this, and I'm lucky to be doing this job. And at the same time, you know, I am absolutely gripped with panic that, it's basically, you know, I think the turnaround came in 102 seconds, and we've got less time than that to sort of try and describe it. So I have to say, I made a complete, which is sort of partly, again, why I went to write the book. I'm not particularly proud of my sort of muddled attempt to put it right. I have to say, reading back some of my colleagues, yeah, they did a much better job on the night, but it was, you were just full of adrenaline. I mean, you know, you couldn't be in that stadium and not be full of adrenaline. But as a reporter, yeah, you suddenly had this challenge of like, how am I going to put this into words? I can barely believe what I've seen, never mind, you know, explain it very well. So you sort of hope that, you hope to use that adrenaline to find the words to describe. I mean, I think actually I spoke to the German commentator, and I think, you know, he actually said he stopped talking on German TV because he said that, I think he said, you know, how do you describe the indescribable? It was like there was nothing to be said. It was just shock and awe, basically.
Well, I wouldn't worry too much about your article. It's not like it's not like 13-year-old boys were going out to buy every single paper the day after and then saving them for the rest of their life. Don't worry.
It's famously chip paper within 24 hours. But no, it was. There is 100% nowhere else you want. You know, I mean, that's one of those nights where, you know, say we're still talking about it now, and I'm still writing a book about it now, and it's. I have to say, when I watched that back for the book, I must have watched that back 100 times, those 3 minutes. And I've got teenage sons now, and I, you know, made them sit down and watch it. And to be fair, they were just like proper goosebumps, you know, even just watching that back now on any day. I think it's impossible to watch it without having goosebumps, because it is such a, you know, not... To win any game like that would, you know, is mad. To win the Champions League final, that clinches the treble, that ends all those years of striving. Because that's the other thing people, you know, I hope it comes over in the book. People have to realise just how much had gone into trying and failing to get this European crown back. You know, it had been years of failure and you know, and wondering if it's ever going to be done. So, you know, so much emotion and was invested in this.
Yeah, well, I've saved the biggest character for last, and that is Sir Alex Ferguson, of course. I mean, the book actually starts with, and I didn't know this, and I won't give too much away because in the book, but a very frank conversation between him and our chairman at the time, Martin Edwards, about Fergie's commitment to the club, and I didn't even know that was a thing. So, but then throughout the book, you just see like what an impact he has on every single player, on every single facet of Man United. And then obviously to get this crown of glory, will there ever be another like Sir Alex Ferguson?
I don't think there will be, because I don't think it's actually possible for there to be another Alex Ferguson. The way he ran a club from top to bottom is just, it doesn't happen now. I mean, we talk about, started off obviously the conversation about where United are now, and you know, that any club now, you know, you can have a big manager who's a big character and you know, his presence is felt everywhere in a club. I'm sure at Liverpool, Jurgen Klopp is, you know, his presence dominates that club, but he wouldn't expect to run, you know, every single department the way, you know, they have their own recruitment department that is, you know, got a huge team itself now. That's, and it wasn't like that then. You know, Alex Ferguson knew everything and everyone who was inside that club. He was in at 7 o'clock every morning. On top of it, I mean, I talk about, this was the old Cliff train. This was the last year at the Cliff training ground, which you go back to now and you can't believe that the greatest team ever came from it, you know. But that was fascinating in itself, because it was this tiny, cramped training ground, and that meant everyone knew everyone else's business. And you can be sure that Alex Ferguson knew everyone else's business there as well. And he was just the most, and I hope, again, this comes through tactically, these were quite basic times. This was not Pep Guardiola football, where he is, intricately moving someone 3 yards and talking about, right, we switched from, 4-2-3-1 to 2-3-5. There was not that choreography now. That Ferguson was not some, guy who reinvented tactics. Above all, he was a psychologist and a motivator. But he did that in a way that is, I think, untouched, will perhaps never be touched. He was a genius at it. He knew how to put fire in the bellies. He knew how to smell when a player's mood wasn't quite right, or when their confidence wasn't quite right. It doesn't mean to say he didn't know footballers and understand it. He knew when, okay, right, we need Nicky Butt for this game, not Paul Scholes, or we need Teddy Sheringham for this one, not, Dwight York, whatever. He was smart, but I think his ability to tap into people was very, very special, and that's what kept him. I remember Roy Keane. Obviously him and Roy Keane ended up having a big dust up, but I remember Roy Keane summing it up and saying, Alex Ferguson knew what to say every day for 25 years at Man United, whether that was a bollocking because he felt the mood had got too complacent, or whether it was a bit of empathy because he could see someone was having a hard time, or whether it was, giving someone a few days off because he could just see that they were frazzled. To understand instinctively what to do and what to say, all the time, not saying he never got it wrong, but it's a very special quality of people skills to have. And I think that was what distinguished him.
Mm. And obviously just the greatest achievement in this club's history, in English football history, we said the treble. Will we see it again, do you think?
Well, it's almost a surprise we haven't. Obviously, as I say, City, City two seasons ago looked absolutely well set for the quadruple. And then obviously they lose an FA Cup semi-final and ultimately the Champions League final as well. Liverpool last season, basically when City were losing on the final day of the league season, I was actually thinking, oh my God, am I going to have to rewrite this book? Take out words like unprecedented and historic. I have to say, when City were 2-0 down and to Aston Villa, I was thinking, this could be the biggest rewrite since 1999, basically. I think this, we are in an age of super clubs now where, there is this huge wealth which can hoover up talent. And I think partly because of that, where it is a surprise. I guess the one difference between England and other leagues is that we do have a very competitive league. So even if a City is flying high, there is a Liverpool chasing them down, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. Clubs keep getting close and falling tantalizingly short. And I think it underlines how special the achievement was. And United it was seat of the pants so many games. And the ability to make those fine margins work for them, again, comes back to partly the skill, but as much the character of a very special group of players.
You put it, stats, there's a bunch of stats at the back of the book, which I quite like, and you can see all the results and times and all things. But the fact that United didn't lose a single game after the Middlesbrough defeat in December, and the only team still in England to have not lost a single game in any competition at the back end of the season, it's very impressive. And that's why this team, for me, obviously one of the greatest teams ever. There was obviously debates and stuff, but this is a United podcast, so we're not going to get into those debates. This is the greatest team ever. One other thing I just wanted to ask you about is, so throughout the book as well, which I quite like as a quite little break from the football, is just other things that are going on around the time, especially in 90s, like whether that be New Labour or Cool Britannia, these things. And how important was for you to like include those sort of things and to capture the era, if you will?
Yeah, really important. Basically, I was, brought up in the South, and then I got the job in the mid-90s doing the Manchester Beat, and I moved up. I didn't know Manchester really at all. And I fell in love with the place, and I got swept along with it. It was the coolest, I think, all right, I can't think there was a cooler place to live I mean, I know obviously the whole Manchester thing had started, you know, before then, but, you know, I felt like I just arrived in this place that was, you know, erupting on so many levels. The, you know, the music was cooler. The football team was, you know, the biggest and best. It was fashionable. It was, you know, I loved it. I'd say I absolutely fell for the place. And so I wanted to capture that. I wanted to capture the spirit of Manchester itself and the city and the vibrancy of it. I wanted to, you know, I think they were fascinating times. As you mentioned, Britpop and so on, there was a different air at the time. And it was amazing to look back and just, as you mentioned, New Labour. Alex Ferguson was massively entwined with New Labour. So, you know, it was also a time when football in the 90s had totally changed profile. You know, it'd gone from, you know, the 80s and hooliganism and the horrors of Heysel and horrors of Hillsborough to, you know, this sort of new Premier League, you know, it just took a different place in society. It suddenly became, you know, mainstream and popular, and the whole boom was taken off, and United were driving that boom. That's the other thing, you know, United were just way ahead of every other club in every aspect, you know, in terms of the profile and the scale and the popularity. And I think there's a mini chapter about they were so popular that that spawned ABU, you know, mm-hmm. anyone but United. So I just wanted to bring all of it together. You know, I was there lucky enough to be at Main Road watching Oasis. That's like felt like a sort of moment of the 90s, you know. I wanted to bring all that in because as I reflected on the story, that was part of the joy of it all as well, that this Manchester had felt like, to me, had the best of everything, you know, had the best music, had the best football team, had the best nightclubs, had, you know, why, again, that's, I feel like I was, you know, doubly privileged to have all that as well.
Well, Matt, thanks for joining. Congratulations on the book. It's a great read. I can't recommend it enough to everyone, as well as all the anecdotes we've talked about. There's loads more. There's about the B-Sky B takeover. You get behind the scenes anecdotes from various players who you don't even think about. There's stuff on David Ellery. If you're really a bigger David Ellery fan, there's something for you there. Honestly, it is a fantastic read about one of the greatest seasons in football history. And as a United podcast, for any Man United fan, I cannot recommend it enough. It's out now. You can get it from all your good look book places, Amazon, wherever. Get it now. It's a really great read. You won't regret it. Congratulations, Matt, and thanks so much for joining us.
No, well, thank you. I really appreciate the invite. And yeah, I just hope I've just conveyed the fun of writing it and the fun of covering it and the fun of looking back on it, because they were great times, very special times. And if that sort of joy has come through, and that's how it felt for the players looking back as well. So no, I appreciate it's been a pleasure to talk.
Yeah, well, listen, it's been such a joy that I've not been put off by the fact that England have just tumbled wickets during this entire conversation. So it's been great. Thanks, Matt.
Cheers.
Yeah, a huge thank you to Matt there for joining us on the pod. If you want to give him a follow, you can follow him at Dickinson Times on Twitter. That's at Dickinson Times on Twitter. And yeah, his book is out now, available in all good and bad bookshops. It's a great read, like I said on the pod, and yeah, just seek it out. It's a really, really good read about one of the best periods of United's history. Before we go, just want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, Manscaped, as always. That's manscaped.com, your go-to place for all the below and above waist grooming needs. They now have a face razor as well as the razor for downstairs. So they've got everything you could possibly need for male grooming. And if you go there and give the code UnitedHour20, you can get free shipping and 20% off your order. That's UnitedHour20 for free shipping and 20% off. That's manscaped.com for all your needs. And that's it for the pod. Make sure you join us next week after the Liverpool game. We'll be talking about that game and what looks like the impending arrival of Casemiro. No spoilers for what I think. You'll have to find out that on the next pod. But yeah, until then, cheers, everybody. United Hour is part of the Sports Social Network. Edited by Imran Lahair. And our theme song is by Ancient Feelings. To get in touch, please follow us on Twitter, United_Hour, or email us at unitedhour@gmail.com.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.